This is The Lonely Voice with Peter Orner from Texas Public Radio. I'm Yvette Benavides. On today's episode, we're talking about The Tea Ceremony by Gina Berriol. Texas Public Radio had the rare and wonderful opportunity to host acclaimed author Peter Orner at a special event last January. After over 5 years of collaborating on The Lonely Voice, we were all in the same room while discussing his latest novel, The Gossip Columnist's Daughter. We also recorded a couple of episodes of The Lonely Voice. We always go back to short stories. We have to. How often does one get to sit in the same room with Peter Orner and talk about stories? And for this special time together, there was one author we just had to make time for, Gina Berriol. If you've listened to this podcast before, you know that we love short stories and that the stories of Gina Berriol are some of our favorites. They sort of set the standard. We've covered a few of her stories over the years, including Stolen Pleasures, a story about two sisters, Fleur and Delia. This time we're talking about The Tea Ceremony, and it features the sisters in their childhood. Front and center is Delia. She's a noticer. She's bright and observant, even if she's rather shy and doesn't really have any friends. But right under everyone else's nose is the fact that the teacher, Miss Ferguson, considers Jolie Lotta something like her pet, a favorite student. Delia easily surmises that what's behind this is Jolie's beauty, and her mother, Adriana, is beautiful too. A tea ceremony occurs in the story, a ritual-filled spectacle that is so sublime that Delia feels like she'd like to capture its beauty by drawing it, but she can't muster a way. And then she considers her own family situation, her rain-stained bungalow, her blind mother, and the disarray and disorder of her home that can't be helped along by her family. Years later, she's still thinking about the ceremony and what the idea of beauty can really mean to her. There's a lot going on here with the idea of beauty, not just for some aesthetic quality or as something life-saving, a transformative force that allows us to transcend a world awry or a life full of compromise. She can escape the confines of her past and the expectations of that life and make her own way, shape her own identity through her appreciation of beautiful things. It is a means of a future for herself, one she feels she can choose for herself. The Tea Ceremony collection was compiled by Berriol's daughter and her partner, Leonard Gardner, following her death in 1999, and is celebrated for its spare, elegant prose. As we've said before on this podcast, and as Peter Orner surmises, Berriol has a knack for taking ordinary characters and situations and imbuing them with a fullness and a dignity that maybe all the rest of us want and deserve too. There's something powerfully emotional in that. This is the way that Berriol manages her characters, these outsiders suffering the losses of goals that they can't quite name, but that they hunger for just the same. That's how Delia feels about beauty, about harnessing it, holding it in some way, if only for a little while. We believe this is precisely what Berriol does with her story writing. She captures the beauty inherent in people's lives. An ordinary world is never just that. Or it is. And there's beauty there, too. How fortunate we all feel to have been in the same room with Peter Orner last January to have the opportunity to discuss a story by Gina Berriol. Well, how lucky can we lonely voices be? Here now, Peter Orner and I discuss The Tea Ceremony by Gina Berriol.
The idea for us with The Lonely Voice is to celebrate short stories. And if you've listened to this podcast before, you know that the objective is to geek out. The objective is to really celebrate the stories that we love. We talk about them, and we hope that people who haven't read the stories might seek them out and read them. The author that started it all for us is Gina Berriol. So this is an author that I discovered, around 1990, 1991. It's a long story, but I found her book, The Infinite Passion of Expectation, when I really needed to find that book. And in the year 2000, I'm sorry, in the year 2020, when I first interviewed Peter Orner, we talked quite a bit about Gina Berriault, and we realized that we have a lot of favorite authors in common, and she is among our favorites. So we decided for the special 51st episode, where we're live in the studio and we're able to record video, that we would talk about a Gina Berriault story. And Tea Ceremony for me is, I don't know, it's almost a sacred story. It's almost too special to utter a word about it out loud. And so that's why I chose it. What do you think, Peter?
Great to be here. Usually we're like disembodied voices, so it's like, here we are. So it's different, and you know, it's great to be here. Thank you for having me. Am I in the mic okay? And yeah, of course, we'd go back to burial as a sort of a celebration of what we've been doing. I think we've done 50 episodes at this point, and our 51st is back to burial. I think we've done 3 or 4 on her already. She's not a writer that's a household name. People always talk about her in the by saying she should be a household name. She's never going to be a household name. And I think there's something beautiful about that. I think she's too, why am I wrong?
She's too.
I mean, I don't want her to be, you know, it's a stupid way to start conversation.
No, it's not. You know, she's not splashy. She was never, I don't really understand the fickleness of the publishing industry. Maybe it's more fickle now than it ever used to be. I really don't know what was happening in her life, because she was a writing teacher, as you know, and
she hated it.
Oh.
That's the word. She taught where I used to teach at San Francisco State, which is a great job, and I loved it. The word that I always heard is what she, it took so much out of her, you know. She probably gave too much or something. I love what you say about splashy. She's not splashy. And, you know, every writer, even like, you know, if you think of like Grace Paley, there's always a little splashy, right?
Somehow, yes.
Yeah. And Berriault, I think, totally resisted that or something, just being very true to herself and doing only what she wanted to do. And for that reason, every story is in and of itself. And I'm just glad you chose this one, which is posthumously published, dedicated to Isaac Babel. She says, for my true friend, Isaac Babel, who died, you know, probably before Berriault was, definitely before Berriault was born, in the early 20s or, well, no, early 30s. So maybe she'd just been born. She was a baby, maybe, when Babel was born. In his basement. And I think that this story is about friendship and how random it can be and how cruel it can be and all of that. So I'm glad to be talking about this. And I agree with you. It is kind of a sacred piece of work.
It is. I feel that way about a lot of her stories, and maybe most especially about this one. And the thing about her, you know, this idea of the fickleness of the publishing world, maybe that's a little unfair. Sometimes it's about timing, or sometimes I don't understand it myself. But the thing about that is, and it goes back to something you have said to me a few times. It's this idea that you feel almost excited about the idea of all of the undiscovered writers that we have yet to find, and whose books we will, and whose stories we will one day read and maybe talk about on The Lonely Voice. And you're always on the hunt.
Oh, we got to be on the hunt. And I, you know, I've said this a million times, said it in print, I've said it to you. You know, people who walk around thinking they read everything, critics or whoever, and that there's nobody yet to discover, are kidding themselves, and their arrogance is like criminal.
Yes. No one should think that they've read everything. Really. I mean, come on.
We know these people. Really,
we know them. It's okay. It's all good. Probably not. But But the tea ceremony, I mean, so we get into the tea ceremony by Gina Burial. The title, the tea ceremony. The idea of a tea ceremony is kind of lost on some people. You know, it's a very specific thing for particular cultures. But she introduces it right off the bat. So we get the context with ocean liners sailed right on through the Depression years, and certain persons who had jobs, like teachers, could go and visit countries that were not at war. Miss Ferguson had been to Japan. She brought to school a silk kimono purchased in Nagasaki for a sum she would not divulge. One of the boys asked her outright, but she bowed her head, smiling tolerantly. "It's not polite to ask those kinds of questions," she said, "so we don't answer them." The boy, humiliated, angry, turned his whole body sideways in his seat and stared out the window. And the kimono hung on a long bamboo rod with a black silk tassel at each end, showing off the wide sleeves to advantage, and the hand-painted scene of a tea house and white cranes waiting in a stream. It had a red silk lining. You could file along before it, but you could not touch it. Miss Ferguson fingered the silk between her thumb and forefinger. "The feel of silk, nothing like it," she said. So it's so interesting to me that the story starts with this really detailed description. And there's a good reason for it. But the thing is, like, you dive right into this idea of why would this teacher be able to go to Japan? It doesn't make any sense. But we walk right into the story, and the first thing we know is why the teacher got to go to Japan and why she has these particular items, and they're hanging in the classroom. But the next thing we hear is that only for Jolie Lotta, as she filed by, did Miss Ferguson point out the kimono's many precious details. So the students are sitting there, and they can hear that she's saying this to Jolie, and only to Jolie. And what is the reason that she is this chosen favorite student?
Because she's beautiful, and her mother is beautiful, and that puts you at in this world, and our world too, I suppose, puts you at the top of the pecking order in some ways for some people. And Miss Ferguson, who is sort of... nasty, you know. Reminds me a little. I mean, this is the geeking out portion of our. But you know, a little bit like the prime, like Miss Jean Brody and prime Miss Jean Brody. You know, these teachers who are revered and remembered and loved, but there's this undercurrent of cruelty in them, and I got a little sense of Miss Ferguson in that. Also, to be further geeky, to go back to the dedication. As she dedicates it to Isaac Babel in his basement. And what she's referring to there is the story in the basement, which is Babel's story about his friend Borkman, I believe his name is, who is this rich man's son, who is coming over to the house for the first time. And the Babel narrator is trying to make sure that his embarrassing family clears out. So the drunken uncle, the drunken grandfather, everyone has an assignment to be gone that day. And so they can impress Borkman. I think, you know, I think about Burial, reading that story, kind of remember, I got one of those. You know, I got a story where my character is trying to impress the most, in this case, the most beautiful person in the class. And that is, Miss Ferguson is, you know, really is... playing into that, you know, and Jolie Lotta, you know, the poor kid, you know, in some ways, and then it gets worse for her. But yeah, and I, like you pointed out, like they're filing by, you know, and Miss Ferguson, you know, singles her out to tell her the details. And everyone, of course, is listening. You know, again, that is a sort of cruelty in that. I guess maybe it's also sort of beautiful that she's having this connection with a student, arguably. You know, is all that.
Yes, and you're making me remember, we just recently did a series of episodes about teacher stories. And, yeah. You know, teachers, I mean, we're teachers. I mean, we understand. And teachers are as complicated as the rest of us. And I think when we're young students, our teachers are really just sort of like this one kind of flat thing. And we've talked about how Charles Baxter writes about the half-known world. And I think I put teachers in that category of the half-known world. Like they're so, my father was a teacher too. And I can tell you that there were so many things that I'm sure the students out there did not know about my father. They really knew him as a very particular kind of teacher, for instance. But that this idea of a teacher, as it's being presented to us by this first person narrator, is that she loves beautiful things. She's willing to share those beautiful things in her classroom because perhaps who else is she going to share them with? But also that she's chosen a favorite among these students, and it just happens to be this kind of doll-like young girl whose mother is also quite beautiful, and then something happens. But the other thing about this, and not to jump too far ahead, Jolie says to the character, my mother, said Jolie Lotta to me one day, wants me to stop being friends with you. She named three girls who went around together and with nobody else, one whose father was the mayor, one whose father was the city attorney, and one whose father was simply rich. And it was these three girls whom her mother wanted for her friends. I already knew what was unfavorable about me, but I knew more emphatically then. I became who I was in her mother's beautiful eyes. Beauty can do that to you. I became the girl who Jolie Lotta's mother saw those few minutes in the drugstore when she appeared to be seeing only her daughter. How skinny my legs, how scrawny my hands. Still an agile child's hands, sun-browned, stained with colored inks, and how unruly my dark hair, and how crazily stitched my clothes by my mother going blind and insisting on sewing up the tears. With the prescience some children have of their life to come, I knew then that I would keep my own distance from them, from those who were perfected by their beauty and by everybody's adoration. The farther the distance, the less the longing to be like them. So this is a moment where we are really, really understanding that this is being told in hindsight, but it is such a hard lesson that it is still with the narrator years on. It's painful.
Painful, and also a very good example of why we keep returning to this writer, I think. How skinny my legs, how scrawny my hands, still an agile child's hands, sun-browned, stained with colored inks, and how unruly my dark hair, and then this comma, and how crazily stitched my clothes by my mother going blind and insisting on sewing up the tears. There it is right there, that sort of almost like extension into, I think, a story that's clearly about the past and, you know, the mother who becomes a character in another Delia story, which I believe we've done.
Mm-hmm.
Stolen Pleasures, which is, you know, as transcendent as the tea ceremony is, we could argue Stolen Pleasure takes a sibling story and takes, you know, anyway, the point is that mother going blind, which I think is a real detail taken from Beryl's own life.
Yes, it is.
Mm-hmm. Is so devastating and beautiful and heartbreaking, and kind of, to me, it's almost like that a sense of pride in, I feel a sense of pride coming from Delia here, not just a beating herself up.
And that's interesting.
That's the, you know, almost like still an agile child's hands, you know, and you know, we're getting in the weeds as we often do, but I get the feeling here that an older narrator is sort of rooting for her younger self. That's how I hear this, even in spite of the fact that she knows on the beautiful front, she is not in this league and not going to be looked upon in the way that Jolie Lotta is looking at those other three girls. She knows that. But I think she's planting her flag, and I don't give a shit. But I might be taking this in a whole nother wrong direction.
Yeah. So, you know, Jolie I think what's interesting is she would have stayed friends with her, but for her mother's influence. And then also,
thanks, Jolie.
Yeah, to your point, I knew then that I would keep my own distance from them, from those who were perfected by their beauty and by everybody's adoration. And I feel like, just as you say, that you can almost imagine the narrator in this present moment as an adult thinking back on this, knowing that she accomplished what she thought at that very moment. And because we know about the stolen pleasure story, and we know about Delia in that story, and Fleur, I don't remember, there's not a brother character in that story, but there is the mother that needed to be taken care of. Such a devastating story about sisters. If you haven't listened to that episode, I hope you will, and look for that story. But also, you know, it sets up this idea about the mother is going blind. She's still having to mend their clothing. There's a reason for that. Nothing is for nothing in these stories. Like, everything means something very important. But in the next scene, Miss Ferguson is asking, I mean, how wrong can a teacher be? She asks the class to point to the one among us who we like the best. Good night.
And then, weirdly, bizarrely, to Miss Ferguson's shock, it seems that Delia is the one they like the best.
I love it.
This cruel question gets turned around, and it seems that everybody else is sort of drawn to Delia in the way that we are. And just, you know, Delia is the one who, of the people in the story, that maybe doesn't triumph in her life, but certainly moves beyond this town and these people, whereas these folks don't. And we know that from Stolen Pleasures, which is not quite fair, but I think you can even hear it in this, and certainly in the last pages or the last paragraphs, where you do feel a certain that she is transcending this place, this small place that she is from. But, you know, they would not have chosen me had they known everything about me, the shameful things that only I knew. Oh, is it Delia? Said Miss Ferguson, not looking at me, looking around to see if some fingers were pointed at some others, and found that they were. Aha, this country is a democracy, she said, and smiled at me consolingly. So it's not every finger is pointing at Delia, but most of them. And that's very disappointing to Miss Ferguson, who worships beauty, as, you know, as we see in the tea ceremony itself, but also in Jolie and Jolie's mother, who becomes notorious in a few paragraphs.
Yes. But first.
Yes.
Wilma. Okay.
When so, I thought today, I was like, what if someone wrote a story about Wilma?
Oh.
Someone should.
Please write it.
No, but tell us about Wilma.
So the shyest girl in class, who was never heard from, began to follow me around. She spoke not one word, that Wilma. Her large, darkly shining eyes doing all the pleading of me to be her best friend. Go away, I said. Go away and stay away. She would not go. She would not let me be alone until one day I pounded on her back, and then she went away. And even as I had thought I was the boy who asked Miss Ferguson the price of her kimono, I thought I was that girl, that Wilma. It's so interesting.
I shouldn't laugh, but I wonder. I was trying to visualize, like, did she pound Wilma on her back when Wilma was facing her? Because I think, like, instead of punching her forward, she, I think, reaches around and smacks her on the back. It's just an odd.
Gosh, but anyway, you slice and it's horrible.
It's beyond horrible. And, you know, but Barry Alt is so, you know, we could, every hyperbolic thing, but she often will make the move. A, that you don't expect, and B, that will undermine her own narrator. You know,
yes.
People are so reluctant to do that, especially if that narrator is somewhat a little bit based on themselves, you know. And she, you know, nobody looks worse in this story than Delia in that moment when she smacks Wilma.
Yeah, terrible.
I have to laugh a little, and that's horrible.
But that's this complexity of the character that Barry always delivers. Always. And in Stolen Pleasures. she does it there too with Delia and Fleur. there's always this sort of undercutting of, you know, I do not want to have a perfect, noble character. Who do you like most in the class? And everybody points at Delia, yay, and she says them for great things. No, she is flawed too. We all are. And Barry Old's world shows us this. We are all complex people. We are all, most of us, doing the best we can. And I feel like this story, there's so much that's gained from showing how human Delia is, you know, because otherwise she's a cartoon character. I mean, she's flat, but there's this other side of her. I don't like her pounding poor Wilma on the back and being so mean and go away. Why can't she be her friend? But we understand this. We all want to be the beautiful, popular girl. We all want to be the one the teacher likes the most. We all want to be the one that gets to enjoy the tea ceremony firsthand and not just as an audience. So I just appreciate this in Barry Old, that she's able to do that in one way or another. And there are other ways sort of couched in here, too.
Yeah, that it's almost like swinging back and forth, and the characters are like, Delia just got elected most liked, and yet she still has no friends on the playground. And Wilma is thinking, well, maybe she could be my friend. And Wilma, it's just, you know, it's so, it is the politics of being this age are expressed right there.
And it's so real, yeah. You know, having been maybe a Delia-like character, you know, you want to show, you would expect her, because she knows what it's like to be made less of, you know, that she would never do that to another human being, but she did it to Wilma.
Not
to
leave no saint.
No, and that's precious.
And you know, I think we're probably, you know, I'm sure there are other people on Earth who will sit here and analyze the comparisons between the tea ceremony story and Stolen Pleasures, but there's not many. Right.
I think they're in this room.
Also, they would notice, oh, there's a brother in one, the sister in the other, but in Stolen Pleasures, and I hate to, you know, we shouldn't go too far off the story, but Delia leaves Floor to take care of her blind mother.
Yes, she does.
Takes off into the city. And so, you know, Delia's no saint, and that's, you know, Delia's got her own ambitions, and they're big, you know, and there are things she can change, and there are things she can't. And one of them is she can leave. And I feel like this story, I don't know, have any idea when it was written in relationship to that other story, but I feel like you can feel her chafing at this, the tininess of this small town in California, and, you know, very much ready to get out of there. But before that, something happens. Something happens, and it's, you know, I mean, there's stories that you read, and there's details you never forget. And one of them for me has always been what happens to Joliata's mother, who's very beautiful. She's a clerk in a store. She seems to be pretty judgmental herself, as she says that she wants Jolie only to be friends with the popular kids and the rich kids and et cetera. But then she is found, well, I'll just read the paragraph. One morning, the moment the bell rang, we went quickly into the classroom, wanting to impress Miss Ferguson with our eagerness to obey rules. And then there's no transition to the sentence. Joliata's mother was in the headlines of the town newspaper, caught at doing something disastrously wrong, something against the strictest of all rules. Adriana Latta, and that's she, again, no transition, no quotations, nothing goes into what seems to be a quote from a newspaper. Adriana Latta, a divorced woman living with her mother and 13-year-old daughter Jolie in the Maple Apartments on B Street, was found near death at the side of her lover, City Councilman Mac McPorter, a married man in the Seaside Motel. Asphyxiated by a leaking gas heater, they were both rescued from death in the nick of time. Our eyes alight, we sat down at our desks. Jolie Latta was absent. And then probably for me, one of my favorite lines of any story that I can recall, she says, some persons are made more perfect by what befalls them, as if whatever befalls them can never make them less, can never bring them low as it might others. So this idea that Jolie Latta becomes even more perfect or more herself because of what has befallen her. And they're all waiting. And we all do this, don't we? Somebody has a catastrophe in their life. If they're in the public eye, and what do the cameras want? They want that face. They want them coming out of the courthouse, you know, whatever it is. And this is Burial somehow captures that in a way that's is such something I definitely have like understood, but never would have been able to articulate. That idea of people being made more perfect by what befalls them. It's just an absolutely extraordinary sentence.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of went off there.
No, because it's so important. And the idea of her absence made, I mean, they missed her, you know, so it's almost like her stock went up, you know.
Totally.
So
4 days she was gone, right?
Yes. One morning she was with us again, slipping in, paler, less spirited. The girls who had taken her into their circle enclosed her again, a prize. And then it's right after this that they have the tea ceremony.
Can I just add one thing?
Yes, yes.
I ripped off that idea.
Yeah?
In the Gossip Columnist Daughter, they in closing her, there was a scene that I was working on where the parents have lost their child, and I had the other friends, not my main character friends,
but
other friends enclose them. And I mean, I'm realizing now it's just completely, you know, ripped off from Burial, that idea. And in my scene, they actually kind of move with them because it's actually literal. But still, I was definitely riffing off Burial, which we can probably cut that from us. We don't need that. But anyway,
I mean, it's a beautiful idea that it was. Anyway.
Yeah, and she, you know, that they just could sort of pull her in, and she, you know, and she's separate. The point is, she's separate from Delia.
But she's the prize. She's not. They're not necessarily comforting her, as happens in a novel.
Aren't people who have disasters happen to them prizes for people?
Mm.
You know, don't you? I have these friends who, when something goes wrong, and I'm like this too. Like something goes wrong, they're all over it, texting like crazy. They want to be the first person to tell you.
Oh yeah.
You know, or they want to be the first person at the funeral.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So. I understand what you mean, yeah. Well, what I was going to say is, like, this is the tea ceremony. There's this huge buildup to this, and suddenly I'm sort of like, oh, yeah, the tea ceremony. And I just have to be honest with you. I can't wait to move to the next page to start talking about Delia again. But the tea ceremony shows, yes, the ceremony of it, the rituals, the steps. But the thing is that it's Jolie Latta and Miss Ferguson. And they're so sort of pious or something. And they're going through the steps, and it's almost like Jolie knows what to do, which also kind of bugs me. All the bowing and all of this.
Well, they've been practicing as well.
Yes. And it's all so perfect. And she even uses the word. At last, you know, so the tea ceremony is all about the rituals that where you're getting everything ready and it has to be just so. And then you get to sip the tea. Perfectly beautiful, said Miss Ferguson. How perfect. And I knew that I would never draw them. My pen would make only false moves and the picture give away my lacking and my longing. She was trying to capture this moment and it was so perfect that she's just like, I can't capture this. I'm not going to be able to capture this beauty that she's talking about, no matter how sort of, you know, subjective it could possibly be, or maybe it's also objectively beautiful. But then, okay, can I just speed through, or did you want to say anything about the tea ceremony itself?
No, I mean, you know,
it is what it is.
It's a gorgeous thing, and they're celebrating it.
Yes.
Steam and how fragrant it is, Miss Ferguson. And they took their time inhaling. I mean, it's hilarious, actually.
So I'm coming down the elevator, but I catch a little snippet of this is terrible. This is so public radio, of Terry Gross interviewing Guillermo del Toro, who's like my one of my favorite people to listen to in interviews, and he's talking about the Frankenstein movie, which is fantastic, of course, and he's saying something about. Because you said it is what it is. He said it is what it is. Acceptance is so profound. Accepting your lot in life, accepting the things that befall you, accepting the terrible things. And he was talking about Job. And then he was talking about the Irishman. and then it was, and many things. But I came down the elevator with this idea of Job, the terrible things that are constantly befalling this character. Acceptance is so profound. And I think there, at a certain point, there is some acceptance for her that she will never be able to capture that beauty. And then what? And she says, nights at home, I thought about that tea ceremony. If Miss Ferguson were ever to visit my family, something she'd never do, but something I feared anyway, she'd know the worst if she came at supper time. Her suspicions about us, and I knew she had some, would be confirmed before her eyes. Other families sat down together while each member of my family ate apart, a family askew, a family alone in a rain-stained bungalow in the weeds, faded curtains from the last house that didn't fit the windows of this one, and my parents' bed, a sagging, fold-out Davenport. My brother, who strode the streets all day or besieged our mother with dreams of fabulous wealth, ate by himself like a lone and hungry wolf, the first to be served by my sister, of course, Fleur. Over in Japan, he'd scare all those tea worshippers out of their wits, teacups crashing to the floor, the teapot loudly cracking apart by itself. Our mother, who was served next, who ate more gracefully than anybody I'd ever seen, but now sat with the dish in her lap, and did not know exactly where in the dish to place her spoon, would never, of course, be invited. Next, my sweet sister and I sat down together, eating our supper just to get it over with, not talking, each knowing enough about what was in the other's unhappy heart. So afraid of making mistakes, my sister would not even be offered a chair where she could sit and watch the ceremony. My father came a long way on the clanking streetcar from the city, from his cluttered little office, and entered quietly and did not sit down to eat until he had kissed our mother gently, lovingly, on the top of her head. He placed only one thing at a time on his plate and ate slowly, and his shirt was white, washed and ironed by my sister, and our mother called him noble. My father, I thought, might possibly be acceptable at some celestial tea ceremony in some far distant time. It's tragic, but it's real.
I mean, in some ways, I think we almost have to stop right there.
Sorry.
Because it's so, no, because that paragraph, that leap that she makes to imagine, to go from the actual tea ceremony, which we've experienced, and we're all thinking like, oh, this is nice, and this is pretty, and whatever. And then she brings it home and invents the scene that never is going to happen, which is that they're going to have this tea ceremony with her, you know, askew family that always eats apart. And then that line about the dad, it always gets me. My father, I thought, might possibly be acceptable at some celestial tea ceremony in some far distant time. It's, you know, again, it's that moment, and I feel it again here, this sort of like, you know what? I may come from this skewed family. I may, our curtains may be from the last house, and they may not fit the winds, but damn it, you know, we are, this is who we are. This is us. And I feel, again, a certain almost self, almost protective for this family, you know? And I don't know. I don't know that we need to go any further. I mean, is that crazy? I mean, the world goes awry. Japan turns out not to be the Japan of Miss Ferguson's dreams, and they turn out to be just do something very dastardly, you know? And that, of course, throws her off. Because nothing is like Miss Ferguson thinks. But I feel like the idea of having the tea ceremony, and I just, that paragraph, I don't love a paragraph more in her work than that one.
Wow.
Yeah.
Because so when she says, when one morning Miss Ferguson says to them, Japan has bombed one of our territories. They have destroyed our ships. They have killed many of our sailors. And they have done it deceitfully. The world went awry. And when she says, the world shattered itself like that teapot my brother's presence would have caused to crack up. She hasn't forgotten about that.
There it is.
And she says, and this, everywhere in the world, millions of people were dying and great cities were blasted into rubble and dust and families huddled together in basements, hiding down there from inescapable night. And then she brings it back to Jolie. You know, somebody asked me and people ask me this all the time. Why should I read short stories? I love long novels.
You know, I'm so tired of defending that.
Well,
aren't you?
No, I'm not tired of it.
You don't get tired of people saying that to you?
Because of this.
Okay.
Because I always have a comeback. So
do they care?
I mean,
am I being cynical?
I don't know.
We are, and that's why I almost saw like I was like, oh, let's not.
Oh, don't say anymore.
No. I just feel like there are people who will maybe pick this story up, and there's a couple of our listeners maybe who have read it, and hopefully others will.
They're out there,
and they'll feel it. If they don't want to feel it, then I don't want to force it out.
Oh, I want to force it out.
I mean, I'm not saying you're saying that. I'm just saying, like, aren't you a little tired of having to defend this?
I don't have to. I just keep talking about it.
Okay.
But the thing is, this is it. Everywhere in the world, millions of people were dying and great cities were blasted into rubble. Because somebody said to me recently, I want stuff to happen, like big things, like big giant things.
Yeah. Like how about World War II?
Yes. And then they said, why do you like short stories so much? Because you don't get all those big, giant things going on for pages. And I said, because it's the small moments, the small human moments. Those are the things, the small moments in the context of the ginormous war and the horribleness. The small moments in, you know, what's happening in Minnesota. The small moments in, I mean, that's so careless and stupid to say that. People are suffering. But I'm saying things are still happening in these little rain-stained bungalows. People are still trying to survive and live and move and keep going and work and love and play and do what they want to do. And I feel like Delia, somewhere in here, she wants to keep going. And she says, Jolie Lotta disappeared from the class and her mother disappeared from the drugstore. I glanced in twice through the display window and could not find her. She's looking. She wants to see, you know, in this context of what's happening out there in the wider world, she can focus laser in on what's happening in her world. And they're not there. They're decimated too. And what's going to happen? She says, years into the war, I began to look for something to call perfectly beautiful. Whatever it was, I couldn't find it again. I heard of a place in another city called a museum of art, and I wandered in. Carpets, like sanctification of my otherwise noisy shoes and fragrant sandalwood throughout the wide spaces, a fragrance I was to return for again and again, as much as for the objects on their pedestals and in their frames. What does that mean? Explain it.
I'm not going to try. I'm going to say, even though we covered fully this story, that there's nothing to replace reading it. Nothing.
Nah.
And you mentioned, you know, little moments as being a way of sort of understanding the more catastrophic ones. Let's go back to the dedication again, which I realize I'm fixated on. But for my true friend, Isaac Babel, in his basement, there's something about that. And I just realized that I may be wrong. Babel was murdered by Stalin's goons in the basement of a prison. I forget the name, outside Moscow. For years and years and years, even his widow did not know what happened to him. Or both of his widows, because he had two. This was a little awkward. they thought that he had been sent to the camps and that he may have died of typhoid fever. In a lot of the biographies that were published in the time before the opening of Perestroika and all that, that's what we think would happen to him in his death. But the fact is he was killed, I think, 3 days after his arrest or something like that, and shot in the head. And I feel like what you just said about sort of, you know, Minneapolis or whatever, like, it's all like, that's in here too, you know? And if you think a short story isn't going to shed light on that kind of horror and that kind of human behavior, then you're not paying attention.
That's the truth. Yeah, that's the truth. The people do need to find this story. And when they read the last part, they will see this idea.
Sorry, I steered away from that.
It's okay. They will see this idea about how, as an older person years into the war, she just decides, I'm going to find beauty.
Yeah.
Jolie, who knows where she is? Adriana is not in the drugstore. Where will she find it? And she says, whatever it was, I couldn't find it again. I heard of a place in another city called a museum of art. And she said, what I had to do, I saw, was imagine their beauty. What I had to do was dream it up. Just what all those artists must have had to do. Wandering around in all that dreamed up beauty, I thought about Jolie Lotta, how she presided at the tea ceremony, how she stirred the tea and poured it and inhaled its fragrance and drank it and nodded in agreement with Miss Ferguson that it was all perfectly beautiful, her own self too. Jolie Lotta amidst it all. If you could save yourself from a world awry by calling up something beautiful, I called up Jolie Lotta from my memory, or I must have called her up from my wounded heart, since even after so long, I wasn't spared the pain of my lacking and my wound. It's not about Jolie Lotta, though, but it is about.
Sure. Isn't it? I mean, it's the image of what she.
And it is the second mention of lacking and longing, as you know. The first mention is when she's trying to draw them and she's like, I can't, I will never be able to capture beauty, my lacking and my longing.
Because she's still Delia from this time in her life.
Mm-hmm.
We carry it around with us,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that's why the story, that's why I think we reread this story again and again. How many times now?
Oh, I don't know.
Right?
Yeah.
And so it's not because we don't know what's going to happen.
That's
you know? We read it again because I think we, in our bones, understand what she's talking about, which is that lacking and longing is something we carry around because most of us are not Jolie Lotta. And of course, Jolie Lotta wasn't Jolie Lotta either.
No, that's a great point. I also feel like Delia, and this happens to us. I think it happens to us. There's such a strong imprint from when we're children that you just can't shake it loose no matter what else you do in your life. And I feel like her, you know, moving through the museum and looking at all the beautiful things and smelling the sandalwood, and she can be in this beautiful space. And I don't know about you, but I think those are the moments when I feel really, really bereft. Like you do fill some void by being immersed in art or film, music, or something beautiful, but it doesn't totally fill the hole.
You leave the museum and get on the bus. Remember?
And that's what she's really saying, like even as an adult, no matter if she leaves her poor mother behind and Floor to take care of her mother.
That's why the story is, you know, always enduring.
Yeah.
You know, and whoever reads it will feel that. Can I make one last point, even though we don't need to, because we just should have ended right there. Let's end there. But I will, maybe we could, like, Beryl is funny.
Is she?
Yes.
Okay.
To begin with, said Miss Ferguson, we all must admire the teapot and the bowls and even the bamboo whisk. They spent a long time doing that. Miss Ferguson made chirpy sounds of belief. a belief in the beauty of the object set before them. Those chirpy sounds are hilarious.
Yes. So, what do you think that sounds like?
I got to go there. But, you know, you can almost imagine, like, how would, let's put ourselves at the desk with Barry Al trying to figure out what this sounds like. Well, they were chirpy. They were chirpy. Like, a kind of like almost, you know what I mean? Like yes. That, she's sort of like,
she is,
she
making
can't even
sounds.
Articulate the sounds. It's sort of like a happy bird. So chirpy. Anyway.
But I wonder about Miss Ferguson, as you say that, like, what kind of life does this woman have? It's like all of her joy is coming from having her little accoutrements in the classroom. And I don't know, it makes me sad. But anyway, people must find, this is the book. This is the tea ceremony, the uncollected writings of Gina Bruno.
Or not find, if you're not inclined.
It'll be hard.
Don't find it.
So, anything? Any last words?
No, that's it. This is an essential writer, obviously.
Gina Berriolt is the author of The Tea Ceremony. This has been The Lonely Voice with Peter Orner. Jacob Rosati composed our theme music. Dan Katz is Texas Public Radio's news director. I'm Yvette Benavides.